When I was in high school, a friend of mine told me about an unusual show he had just seen called Floyd Collins. It's a musical, he said. It's weird, but I think you'll like it. I can only assume he thought, Kevin Morris, weird musical, match made in heaven. Got it. About a week later, I found myself at the Shaw Festival, a repertory theater company in Niagara-on-the-Lake, Ontario, just 30 minutes from my front door. To those who've never been, Niagara-on-the-Lake is this quaint little tourist town, with shops, restaurants, and apothecaries that sometimes feels like you've stepped into the past. My unusual theater outing basically began the moment I got to the theater.
Didn't people have to like walk up like 3 flights of stairs from the sidewalk?
This is Jeff Madden. I've known Jeff a long time. And my first time seeing him on stage as an actor was in Floyd Collins. The show was staged on the top floor of what had once been the area's district courthouse.
I mean, it was a converted theater. It certainly wasn't designed to be a theater. So not only did they have to walk up 3 flights of stairs, there was like a lobby the size of a living room. And then you had to go back up another bunch of stairs and down the VOMs, right? Because they were like vomitoriums. The stage was on the floor and then people sat on 3 sides up on these risers around. Yeah, it was crazy.
As the lights dimmed in what might have been a half-filled house, an actor dressed in overalls and heavy muddy boots entered the stage with an acoustic guitar. Sitting on a stoop, he began playing the opening number, The Ballad of Floyd Collins.
Deep in the land of the hollows and creeks, if and you get lost for weeks. Listen to the tale of a man who got lost 100 feet under the winter frost.
Even knowing I was walking into something unusual, I don't think I was actually prepared for Floyd Collins. I was in awe the entire time, from the harrowing story to the incredible sounds coming from the small band at the back of the stage. Walking back to the car at the end of the night, I don't think I knew what to make of the show. When I got home, I called a friend of mine and told her I'd just seen this unusual musical. It's weird, I told her, but I think you'll like it. So I went again, and this time I noticed the audience was fuller than the last. After that performance, my friend and I immediately bought tickets for 2 more nights. At the last night, the closing night, I looked around and not one seat was empty, with the audience made up of people who had already seen the show 2 or 3 times now. I think we all had been taken by this unusual and extraordinary little show. This episode of Staged Right will cover the musical Floyd Collins, as well as exploring the incredible real-life events that inspired the show.
I knew that I could make it whatever I wanted.
We literally thought we were writing a good old-fashioned musical.
We'll also hear from the authors of Floyd Collins about the creation of the piece and how this off-Broadway show will soon be making its Broadway debut after almost 30 years. This and more coming up on Staged Right, the podcast edition. It's a pitch I've been working on for 20 years now. Explaining how one of my favorite musicals is about a guy who gets trapped in a cave. There's always this look people give me, and believe me, I get it, trust me. It's a very unusual premise. To some, it may actually sound familiar, too. The 1951 film Ace in the Hole, directed by Billy Wilder, follows a cynical hack reporter, played by Kirk Douglas, who exploits the tragedy of a man trapped in a mountain cave in New Mexico. For reasons that may have verged on legal, the movie makes efforts to distinguish itself from the Floyd Collins story, even at one point referring to it directly.
You never heard of Floyd Collins? 1925? Kentucky? One of the biggest stories that ever broke. Front page in every paper in the country for weeks. Say, what'd you take at that school of journalism? Advertising?
The movie was also purported to be inspired by Kathy Fiscus, the 3-year-old girl who had fallen into an abandoned well in San Marino, California in 1949. If this sounds familiar, you might be thinking of the 1992 episode of The Simpsons, Radio Bart, where a media circus descends upon Springfield after Timmy O'Toole becomes trapped in a well. This, of course, a lavish prank played by Bart.
Bart, what's wrong with you?
Yeah, that Timmy is a real hero.
How do you mean, Dad?
Well, he fell down a well and can't get out.
How does that make him a hero?
Well, it's more than you did.
It was actually, roughly about the time this episode aired, that Adam Gettle and Tina Landau began working on Floyd Collins. The two had met while studying at Yale. She, an aspiring writer and director. He, a musician with ambitions of composing. They also shared a lot as well. Both were raised in New York City, born into so-called showbiz families. Both Tina's parents, Edie and Eli Landau, worked in film and television, producing the movie version of Long Day's Journey Into Night with Katharine Hepburn, later producing screen adaptations of theater works by playwrights like Albee, O'Neill, and Pinter. Adam's mother was Mary Rogers, composer of the score for Once Upon a Mattress and author of children's books, including the novel Freaky Friday, which inspired several movie adaptations and eventually gave us this fabulous moment.
Okay, that's enough.
Her father, of course, was Richard Rogers, composer of some 40 Broadway shows and over 900 songs. In their own respective work, Tina Landau and Adam Gettle have pushed against the conventions and commercial trappings of show business. Greg Evans of Variety once noted Tina Landau's avant-garde sensibility as a writer and director. Her quote, "idiosyncratic blend of traditional narrative, performance art, dance, and song." With director Ann Bogart, she would develop the viewpoints technique, and her collaborators have noted her unpretentious process of unearthing the truth of a piece. As a musician, Adam Gettle's musical sensibilities often betray the confines of a commercial, sometimes stubborn art form like the musical theater, melding elements of pop, jazz, and classical music, pushing the form of a song beyond ABAA into the realm of art music. In a New York Times article titled True Believers in the Future of Musical Theater, Adam Gettle told Barry Singer, "Musical theater in the abstract, I'm sort of in love with. Musicals are a completely marginalized, sort of contemptible pop culture field that gets no respect." Later saying, "I don't think musicals have gotten an unfairly old-fashioned reputation. My generation is stuck with trying to reverse that perception." That article was from 1997. In fact, Janine Tesori is mentioned in passing as a composer having not yet worked on Broadway then. Most in-depth conversations I found surrounding Adam's work involved his later shows like the Tony-winning Light in the Piazza or Days of Wine and Roses. While he has talked about Floyd Collins in the past, I was curious what he might say about the show today. While already writing a script for this episode, I breezily sent word to my various contacts, seeing if anyone would help me connect with Adam Gettle and ask if he might be willing to speak with me. All the while, I thought, there's no way. There's no way. After 2 weeks of exchanging messages, I set up a time to speak with Adam Gettle over Zoom. At the time of our conversation, Adam was in the middle of casting for the upcoming Broadway mounting of Floyd Collins and found time to chat with me from his studio in New York.
Are you a composer, like when you have a particular project, whether it's Floyd or anything else, do you immerse yourself in a genre or particular recordings to kind of get into that headspace?
Well, I think more immersed myself in my kind of tactile or visceral experience of the kind of music I'm going to be living in and writing in. I don't do a lot of research. For Floyd, I listen to a lot of monophonic music, a lot of Lomax recordings, a lot of Skillet Lickers and Doc Watson family, just to sort of understand some of the treatments and instrumental sort of idioms, but not much more than that. With Piazza, I didn't really, I just, you know, I have this vast database of, you know, Rachmaninoff and romantic music just from having loved it my whole life. And then with Days of Wine and Roses, you know, I played jazz for years. My first sort of thing, I thought I was going to be a bassist, an upright bassist, a jazz bassist. So I had a lot of that stored up too. But I think the idea was to avoid aping anything, you know, just to let it be a reference and a resource, but not something that I would want to kind of trace.
Yeah, like kind of avoid a pastiche kind of feel, if that's what you mean.
Yeah, because I also don't really have the technique to do pastiche well. I just want to be in work to make sure that's the case. You know, it's, I guess it's always going to sound like me to some degree. For instance, the latest thing I'm working on, which I'm not going to go into too much, but it's definitely very different from Days of Wine and Roses. And Millions, which we're doing at the Alliance in Atlanta in the spring, is a propulsive, nearly pop score with a couple ballads. And yeah, so you know, I try to retool the factory every time.
After departing Yale, Adam Gettle and Tina Landau collaborated on an adaptation of A Christmas Carol at Trinity Rep in Rhode Island. During a Floyd Collins reunion, hosted by Seth Rudetsky and James Wesley in 2021, Tina Landau described how that production of A Christmas Carol brought forth the opportunity to create their next project together.
We were commissioned by the American Music Theater Festival, it was called at that point, in Philadelphia by a woman named Marjorie Samoff.
We each brought in like six ideas, and mine all had to do with like the plague or some esoteric shit.
I actually found this thing in, I think it was something like Reader's Digest Great American Stories or something.
Something out of a book called like Louisville Life in the 20s or something, like a Reader's Digest thing. And it said,
Death Watch Carnival,
man trapped in cave, media circus ensues.
I think I was very taken by the media circus, and I think Adam immediately went to the character of Floyd and what drives someone like that and what is that journey.
In many ways, Floyd Collins was extraordinarily ordinary. Born in 1887 in the Mammoth Cave region of Kentucky. In their excellent book, Trapped, The Story of Floyd Collins, Robert Murray and Roger Brucker said of Floyd, he grew up in a large family at the end of a dirt road in a backwoods area. He was basically uneducated, spent most of his life on or near the farm where he was raised, and died only 4 miles from his birthplace. Floyd's efforts to distinguish himself, often by breaking from the day-to-day of his family's farm life, would only widen the rift between him and his father. Floyd's fascination with cave exploration began as early as 6 years old, and in 1917, he, along with his younger brother Homer, discovered Great Crystal Cave on the Collins family property. Floyd intended to make it a tourist destination, becoming a player in the so-called Kentucky Cave Wars, a period of bitter competition between local cave owners. But Crystal Cave was too far off the beaten path, 4.5 miles off the main road. And in the end, the cave would fail to provide a steady profit for the Collins family. But Floyd kept hope for building his own enterprise, believing the area underground bore an undiscovered network of caves, perhaps linking closer to the main road. Knowing of a sand hole on a neighboring property, Floyd signed an agreement with B. Doyle to begin digging in the area, working through much of January 1925. On the morning of Friday, January 30th, Floyd Collins entered the overhang of the cave on B. Doyle's farm and squeezed down through the narrow entrance into the passageway he had been working on for weeks then. Setting out to begin his own research, Adam Gettle drove down to Barron County, Kentucky, where the events of the story took place.
I went to Louisville, and it was well before the internet, so I did tons of microfiche, you know, Xeroxing, and I got to sit on the porch with his cousin and pretended to be a National Geographic reporter, and they let me in to Crystal Cave for 45 minutes, and I wrote the lyric to something that's in the show called It Moves, and that lyric is just a straight copy from the notes that I took in the cave wearing a pith helmet and with a park ranger watching the clock. And I mean, he had me leave at the stroke of 45 minutes. Being in caves, if you've ever been in caves, especially like Mammoth Cave or the caves out west, I mean, it's really incredible, the feeling of being that far underground with absolutely no light. It's a combination of a very perilous, endangered feeling and a deep, kind of silence and closeness to something greater than one. It's a very interesting combination of those things, and I guess it's a little bit like death itself, or that's what I imagine.
Another place Adam visited was the site that had once been B. Doyle's farm. In the decades following the incident, Sand Cave, as the press would later call it, had gone dormant and fallen off the radar for those visiting the area. After parking his car on the edge of the road, Adam trudged through a dense, buggy patch of woods.
Maybe a third or a half a mile on a not well-trodden path at that time. There was barely a path, but you get to this, not even a clearing, you get to a place that's only clear because there's a ledge of rock, ledgy rock, and where I was, where you approach from, it's in front of you, so the ledge hangs over still what looks like a hole that goes down in, and there were still some old rotting timbers from when they were trying to build a shaft. The cave entrance is not some kind of National Geographic ninth wonder of the world. It's sort of an anonymous little hole in the ground.
The entrance to the cave, however, had been sealed up long ago. An engineer once described the passages of Sand Cave as, quote, a death trap. Using nothing but a crowbar and a shovel, Floyd Collins forged down the impossibly narrow passageway. You can look up diagrams of the cave passage online, and when you see it, you can't believe that anyone would put themselves through such an ordeal. Floyd would have gone down a series of sloping passages, sometimes left with no other choice but to go down head first. Through years of experience, he could skillfully squeeze his way through the claustrophobic space, using his stomach, hips, and shoulders to crawl or move himself along. According to Floyd, he had found a cavern about 60 feet deep, hinting at the possibility of, quote, a big cave beyond. He might have explored further, but his flickering kerosene lamp told him it was time to go. On his way back up, he struck a loose rock above, dropping on his left foot at the ankle. He was trapped. The light had gone out, and struggling only made things worse. He cried out for help, but it was no use. Floyd Collins was alone. With his family accustomed to his long disappearances, it would be a full day before anyone suspected that something was wrong. With their commission from the American Music Theater Festival in tow, Adam Gettle and Tina Landau began work on Floyd Collins. In approaching the score, Adam Gettle envisioned two different musical worlds, that of the world above and that of Floyd's below in the cave.
I knew that I could make it whatever I wanted. Use any instruments, because it's his world and no one else has seen what he's seen. So it could sound like anything I want. And in the very beginning, I thought, well, that's interesting because I can have that down there and then above ground with a song like Tween a Rock and a Hard Place. I can cleave slightly more closely to what would have been happening and what would have sounded like above ground in 1925 in Barron County, Kentucky.
I heard that you learned guitar to approach Floyd. Is that true? Like, how true is that?
Yes, it's definitely true. And learning instruments is a big part of how I sort of keep myself out of trouble, by which I mean keep myself out of doing the same thing over and over. So yeah, I learned guitar on Floyd. And so the first song I wrote for Floyd on guitar was The Ballad of Floyd Collins, which has like four chords or five or six. And the last song I wrote for Floyd was Lucky, which I think has lots more chords than that.
Did it vacillate between guitar and piano?
Yeah, like Through the Mountain and The Ballad were the first songs that I wrote on guitar, but lots of things needed to be a pianistic, partly because I was brand new to the guitar. I couldn't really cover that much territory with that instrument. And having come from the bass...
Okay, obviously this is a podcast, so you can't see what I see. But at this point, Adam gets up and grabs an acoustic guitar that just happens to be sitting on a stand behind him.
You know, I have a kind of poor man's technique. I mean, it's hardly could be called technique, but like, sort of a knocky, boxy.
And obviously you can't see this either, but he proceeds to pick at the strings while adding an occasional percussive strike. Not knowing live music was going to be part of our conversation, my audio wasn't patched correctly, so I couldn't really hear his playing. Still, looking back at the footage, watching Adam Gettle soundlessly play his guitar for me, I have this big, stupid smile on my face.
It's just messy and irreverent and untrained, which is just all I had to work with. And so the score kind of wrapped around that. But there were things that I couldn't use that nascent technique to accomplish. So that was certainly going to end up on the piano. And I wrote one song, not my favorite song in the world, but one song for Floyd was written on the upright bass. And so I sort of end up choosing whatever instrument seems like it's going to carry the emotional sort of vector and the kind of gust and the wind of a given emotional moment for a character. And different instruments do that. The percussive nature, the almost drumming nature of the piano for the Riddle song in Floyd was, why I went there for that. It just felt masculine and fraternal and playful and kind of manically irreverent.
Performers love singing Adam Gettle's music, challenges and all. While speaking with Jeff Madden, who has performed and taught Adam's work, he offered his insight on what distinguishes the composer.
He has more of a classical music influence than most modern composers. And he's not afraid of like bringing that musicality to his scores, where if he doesn't want to write in 4-4, like he doesn't have to, you know, if he wants to throw in a 5-4, a 6-4, a 7-4, whatever, he does. Aside from that, he is an incredible singer himself. So he knows the voice and he knows how expressive it can be. And so he can write these melodies like that, again, just nobody else can write that way, I think, just because of his own unique experience.
Adam's music can also be intimidating to work on, with its vocal demands and intricate score notations. But rather than simply writing something challenging for its mere sake, Adam is rather considerate of the performer, using his specificity as a guide for them.
You want performers to look forward to the entire show and look forward to all the songs they're singing. If there's something that's truly impossible, except for two people on earth, it's just not practical. There are a couple notes that have alternate notes in various scores. I think that's fine as long as it's enharmonically sort of juicy or almost as fun. Sometimes a performer will take the high road or they'll take the low road, depending on where their voice is in a particular production or where they are in their process. And I'm fine with that as long as I can adjudicate what notes those are. And also a couple things that are just better. Like in Floyd, there's, you know, I know, you know. So, ba-da-ba-da-doo-doo-ba is the thing. But people just don't really usually get it. And that's something I have to work on with them. But I know it's achievable and it's way better. They go, you know, I know, you know, I know you. That's what they do. But it's, you know, I know, you know, because no, you know. Those accents where they are is just much more fun and jerky and brotherly. And so sometimes I'm pretty much of a stickler about it when I know it's possible. It's not, you know, we did it in an audition the other day. And I just asked someone who sang beautifully, but sort of was approximating that, if he would do it again and get it right. And he did. And some things are not hard once you know what they are. But when I'm really precise on the page so as to avoid it seeming like, you know, if you have country shuffle up above and then everything is written out really straight, then you're going to get a real twangy Family Feud sort of approximate, cheesy. But if you write it out, you know, with ties over the measure line and you know, lots of 16th notes or whatever, it's not to be pretentious. It's to create colloquialism. It's to create something that's idiomatic to the world that you're writing into. Because if you relax into the general idioms of, let's say, country music, well, the score isn't country music. Neither is it bluegrass. It's actually derived from hill music, which is a combination of Irish and Afro influences. I wanted to be very specific and leave very specific coordinates.
While writing the show's book, Tina Landau would occasionally take dramatic liberties without totally affecting the real-life story. Nellie Collins, for instance, Floyd's younger sister who suffered bouts of mental illness, is largely peripheral in the actual telling of the Floyd Collins story. In Tina Landau's book, she is put at the forefront of the story, an innocent, trying to remain hopeful against all odds. Actress Teresa McNally, who would originate the role in Philadelphia before taking it to New York, would say in 2021,
"My character is mostly made up. Floyd did have a sister, but she sure wasn't like dancing around and trying to get him out."
I think Adam and I would both go on record as saying, at that time in our lives, Carrie was our muse. We wrote this role for her. We wrote around her. We just needed that light and that spirit and that ghost on our stage.
Even with these dramatic liberties, Tina Landau would dedicate herself to the true life story, no matter how extraordinary the facts may have been. On the morning of Monday, February 2nd, 1925, 20-year-old William Burke Miller arrived by taxi at B. Doyle's farm. The city editor of the Louisville Courier-Journal had sent his young cub reporter to cover the Floyd Collins story. Floyd had been in the cave since Friday, and his entrapment was only just starting to be read in the news. Thin-faced, standing at 5'5" and weighing barely 120 pounds, many would refer to William Miller as Skeets, as he was, quote, "no bigger than a mosquito," a young man who regarded journalism as a temporary job before pursuing his dream of being an opera singer. Looking at his staff photo from about this time, Miller's boyishness is undeniable, and it's not hard to imagine the bemused reaction when he arrived at the mouth of Sand Cave that Monday morning. When asked how his brother was, Homer Collins glibly suggested to Miller that he go down and find out himself. Remarkably, that's exactly what he did. He wasn't the first reporter at the scene, but he was the only one small enough to fit through the narrow passageways. Going down head first, as Homer instructed, Miller inched his way through the treacherous path, landing on what he recalled as a wet mass that groaned and moved. Floyd was lying in a reclining position, with barely any room between his chest and the top of the cave. His left arm was partially pinned underneath him, his right arm rendered totally useless. A stream of water trickled from the limestone above and dripped into his face. He had been trapped in the cave for nearly 72 hours then, cold and exhausted, lying in his own waste. There was nothing Miller could do right then and there, perhaps only give Floyd the most meager words of encouragement. After an hour, Miller emerged from the cave and burst into tears. It was an experience he would never forget. While covering the story, as well as doing his due part in the rescue mission, Skeets Miller would brave the terrifying path down several times, getting one of the few authentic accounts from Floyd himself in the cave. Reportedly, he once told Miller, "I faced death before. It don't frighten me none. But it's so long. So long." What started as a local rescue mission soon became a national crisis. The National Guard and the Red Cross would be called, along with engineers and mining experts. So-called natives of the area would resent, as they saw, outsiders intruding on their turf, and a constant air of tension would persist throughout the rescue efforts. It may be hard for some to imagine now, with the news cycle literally in the palm of our hand, that most people's way of knowing about the Floyd Collins story was through reading the newspaper. Some may have heard about it on the radio, but this was 1925 and not everyone owned a set. So the fact that an estimated 20,000 people from all over the country traveled to that tiny patch of land is even more extraordinary. While some came to offer help, others had come to do business. Jugglers, medicine men, preachers, and movie crews descended on B. Doyle's farm to exploit the crisis, the height of which arrived on February 8th, what came to be known as Carnival Sunday. Tina Landau would recall, "The more facts Adam and I discovered, the more surreal the story became. We learned about women who arrived hoping to descend into the passageway and marry Floyd. We learned of an on-site trial that occurred as various factions accused each other of hindering the rescue process. We learned of a young unknown pilot who waited in a neighboring field to fly photographs back to a home office. His name was Charles A. Lindbergh. The details of what transpired at Sand Cave seemed endless and increasingly fascinating. She also noted that as the first great media circus of the modern age unfurled, Floyd Collins himself was all but forgotten, even as rescue crews continued attempts to free him. Whenever there wasn't anything new to write about, reporters simply made stories up, largely caricaturing the Collins family as backwood hicks in colorful and clever copy. After a cave-in that cut Floyd off from the rescue mission, a shaft was built downward to reach the passage that held him. But by then, it was already too late. On February 16, 1925, Floyd Collins was found dead. Doctors determined he'd been dead for days, succumbing to starvation and exposure in the cave. Attempts to raise Floyd's body were abandoned after the shaft down to him was deemed too unstable. He would lie there for months until his brother Homer raised funds to recover the body. A brief funeral service was held on the grounds the next afternoon. Afterward, members of the Collins family parted in opposite directions. In another telling, tragedy might have united this family in crisis, but in the Floyd Collins story, tragedy would only splinter them apart. By the next day, Cave City, once booming with tourists and tradesmen, was virtually deserted. The Park Daily News wrote, "In a few weeks, the people will stop talking about it. We are prone to forget the dead. So it will be with Floyd Collins." The following year, William Skeets Miller would be awarded the Pulitzer Prize for his reporting of the story. He would go on to have a long news career in radio and television. Reflecting years later, "It will be my everlasting regret that I could not effect his release, but never will I be weighed down with a feeling of personal responsibility for the death of Floyd Collins." On February 9th, 1996, the musical version of Floyd Collins began performances off-Broadway at Playwrights Horizon, having gone through a huge overhaul since its Philadelphia premiere 2 years before. Playwrights Horizon, a not-for-profit theater on 42nd Street, had seen the premiere productions of musicals like Sunday in the Park with George and Falsetto Land before their eventual Broadway transfers. With a cast led by Christopher Invar, Jason Danieli, and Teresa McNally, Floyd Collins had all the makings of becoming a hit that season. There was, of course, another musical running off-Broadway at the time. Rent had only been running 2 weeks by the time Floyd Collins began performances, but was already being hailed as the next great American musical. The attention around the show may have been even more intense with the news of Jonathan Larson, the show's composer, passing away before the show's first performance. By the time Floyd Collins opened at Playwrights Horizon, Rent was selling out at New York Theatre Workshop and had announced its Broadway transfer. Some have argued that the reception of Rent overshadowed that of Floyd Collins. Floyd's reviews overall were generally positive, and the show did have fans, but all anyone could talk about was Rent. We can think of a theater season as being subject to the alchemy of that moment. Another hit show that year, Bringin' Da Noise, Bringin' Da Funk, had transferred uptown from the Public Theater, and maybe some felt that the Broadway season that year was too competitive for a show like Floyd Collins to run. The musical would ultimately close at Playwrights Horizon on March 24th, after playing just 25 performances. The following week, Adam Gettle told the New York Times, "We weren't surprised that it didn't get moved, but we were disappointed." But this, of course, wouldn't be the end of Floyd Collins. A cast album featuring the off-Broadway cast would be invaluable in not only preserving the score, but helping the show be discovered by those who did not see the original production. In 1999, the show would have a small tour through the States, helmed again by Tina Landau, before making its American regional and UK premiere that very same year. In 2000, Stephen Sondheim listed The Riddle Song from Floyd Collins as part of a list he called Songs I'd Wish I'd Written, at least in part, along with works by Cole Porter, Leonard Bernstein, and George Gershwin. The show made its Canadian premiere in Edmonton, Alberta in 2003, and in 2004, I wandered into the Courthouse Theatre in Niagara-on-the-Lake to see this weird and unusual musical. Even after seeing multiple shows on Broadway and in London's West End, this regional production of Floyd Collins, starring Jay Turvey, Glynis Rainey, and, of course, Jeff Madden, is still to this day one of my favorite theatrical experiences ever. Dare I say, life-changing. In speaking with Jeff, who played Homer in that production, it was heartening to hear that Floyd Collins had a great deal of meaning for him too.
It was thrilling, Kevin, I'm not going to lie. Like, I nerded out on this production and on this score, and it just felt like I'm getting goosebumps just talking about it now, because it just felt like everyone was so ready for it and so on the same page for it. I have two older brothers, and believe it or not, both my older brothers have almost died. And I just get incredibly emotionally engaged in a story about brothers. So working on Floyd was, you know, being his younger brother was very easy for me to be emotionally like tapped in. Singing Daybreak with Jay, again, what a gift that was every night to sing Daybreak. And then just the sheer joy and release of doing the Riddle Song, the way we staged it, where we got together and we got to get him up off the rock and on his feet, and we could like dance and goof around and do our whatever our monkey walk is. Like, I don't know what we were doing, but just goofing around. I remember my outfit, like I remember my costume. I mean, I just have these like very vivid memories, even though it was 20 years ago, that I don't have for most of the other shows that I did back in the early days of my career, yeah. I am still, like, if I ran into Jay or Glynis or Jeff Lillico or literally any of them, Kevin Dennis, Ben Carlson, Cam McDuffie, like, I would just give them the biggest hug and we would immediately reminisce about it, you know?
Given its subject matter, it's remarkable the capacity Floyd Collins has in inspiring people, surprising audiences with its humor, its heart, and enduring message of hope.
Floyd has had a very nice life, and I suspect that Floyd will never really date. I try to make things period pieces and exotic enough that they won't date. In other words, I don't imagine I'll ever write something like Company, even though that score is so glorious and the themes are so universal, you know, albeit urban, it'll always be relevant. But a lot of contemporary things, I mean, they date like track lighting.
After spending several weeks with the Floyd Collins story, I have often thought about the man himself. There are only a handful of pictures of him that survive today, but there is one that I've come back to several times. In the photo, Floyd's wearing this shabby-looking suit. His tie is clumsily done up, but his hair is carefully combed, and his face is rather handsome. A ribbon that says, Great Crystal Cave is pinned to his lapel. Maybe this was meant as some kind of publicity shot to bolster business for his struggling enterprise. In the photo, Floyd is looking directly into the lens of the camera, directly at us, with this very serious look. It's this, I think, that's brought me back to this photo time and time again. There's this hunger in his stare, almost desperation, like he's really hoping something's finally going to take. Maybe it was that desperation, that hunger, or determination that brought him to the mouth of Sand Cave in January 1925.
It begs the question, why does he do this? And that aria that I was talking about, It Moves, is the answer to that question. And it used to be in the first act, and we are going to move it to the second act.
One of the reasons Floyd hasn't happened in New York in a major production is because we have kept withholding the rights because we want to do our next version of it.
Floyd has always been a court low in the second act. We don't have quite enough Floyd. He disappears for a while and it's not good for the show. These are the things that we're addressing now.
What we hope to do next is to take those wonderful aspects of it that were kind of young and naive and fresh and bring to it what we've learned as artists since. And I think we're really looking forward to giving it one more once, very subtle. It's not going to be an overhaul, but it's going to be a new version that I think will allow us to pour into it the artists and writers we've become today.
You know, the thing about re-examining a piece is that you don't want to operate on a patient whose anatomy you've completely forgotten. There are thousands of decisions that go into making something, and then you see it 30 years later, and you're like, well, that's stupid. We should do this instead. And then you realize you've unraveled, like, now the duodenum is plugged and the spleen is getting blue, and, you know, and you've screwed something up by not knowing how it was attached to something else. You know, it's hard to trace your steps, retrace your steps. We're being really, really careful about that.
The Broadway premiere of Floyd Collins, the first New York revival of the show, is expected to begin performances March 27th, 2025, starring Jeremy Jordan and Lizzie McAlpine, almost 30 years since the off-Broadway premiere and 100 years after the death of Floyd Collins himself. It's a production that many are curious about, and one that I hope to see. The Louisville Courier-Journal, the paper that Skeets Miller reported for, wrote of the Floyd Collins tragedy, "The world is a world of human beings, and every fellow being with a spark of imagination could and did put himself in that man's place." Years later, reflecting on this quote, Tina Landau would say, "I think that's why Adam initially pointed to the paper about the man trapped in the cave. Not because it made an obvious choice for a musical, far from it, but because the single distilled image tapped into something so deep for both of us, our most primal fears of stasis, entrapment, and death, and our most soaring aspirations for life, adventure, and as Floyd would put it, glory." Thank you for listening. A very special thank you to Adam Gettle and Jeff Madden for taking part in this episode. And thank you to Odette Yazbek, Seth Hrdetsky, and James Wesley for helping make this episode possible. As well as video episodes of Staged Right on YouTube, you can now enjoy the podcast edition of Staged Right wherever you get your podcasts. Please follow and share, and if you want to support Staged Right in a flexible, affordable way, please consider contributing via my Ko-fi or Patreon accounts. You can find links in the description. If you have a question or request for future episodes, don't forget that you can follow Staged Right on most social platforms. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned for more.